हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम हरे
हरे। So this is part of a presentation about Yajurveda Sindhu. Some of you may have read part of the book. Sometimes it looks a little very confusing or difficult or whatever for people to understand that word. But actually it's very essential for our progress in Krishna consciousness. And therefore Srila Prabhupada wrote this work quite early among all the different books that he wrote. It came out in the very beginning actually. Probably the second book or something that came out along with his translations of Bhagavatam. So, we're just going to cover the first chapter, actually. And as the title of this verse suggests, it's all about bhakti rasa, the sweetness of bhakti rasa. When we hear the word rasa, maybe we think, well, that's too elevated, etc. It's too high. But that's actually our goal. Our goal is actually rasa, which is equivalent with ananda. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody likes to suffer. Who wants to suffer?
Who wants to get sick?
Who wants to die? Nobody wants to die. Nobody wants to get sick. Nobody wants to have suffering. So the jiva by nature wants to be happy. But it is impossible in the material world. But it is also possible in the spiritual world. So we can achieve that goal of happiness in the spiritual world. Okay? And that is achieved by bhakti rasa. So rasa does not imply one person, it implies two persons. Jiva and Krishna. So therefore our happiness depends on our relationship with Krishna. And that is full of sweetness. It's also immortal. Amrita means, of course, nectar. But nectar also means amrita, literally means without death. It is eternal. So this is how we get our eternal happiness, eternal satisfaction, through our relationship with Krishna in devotion or bhakti. So, in the material world, it's described that we're in drowning in the ocean of samsara, where there jivas were all struggling to survive, but we're actually drowning in the ocean of suffering. And so we meet continual problems, and birth, death, old age, disease, etc. So, the opposite of that is the ocean of bliss in the spiritual world. We don't drown there, but we swim in the ocean. We play in the ocean. But it's another ocean. Just as the material ocean is very difficult to get out of, we can never avoid suffering in the material world. We can never avoid birth and death. So, because the ocean is very big, we cannot swim across the ocean and get to the other side. So in the spiritual world, we have an ocean of bliss, infinite bliss, that never stops. There's no end to it. So that is the attainment or the goal of the jiva, to get that state of eternal bliss. So, Rupa Goswami, who is our Rasacharya, he has written this work on the instructions of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to define this relationship with Krishna in terms of rasa, which of course is very high, because that means you have to have prema to get rasa. However, to get to that stage, then we have sadhana. So most of this work, Bhakti Rasamrita, is concerned with the rasa, that is the state of prema. So we have actually four parts of the work. Most of the work, the other parts, are all rasa. So we have the big ocean, and then the ocean is divided into parts according to the directions, sadly, not east, west, north, south, etc., in the big ocean. So the first part is the eastern part of the ocean. So this is the part that tells us how we get up to prema. Then we have the southern section of the ocean, and the western section of the ocean, northern section of the ocean, that completes the work. So there's four parts of the work. And the other three are all about rasa. First part is defining bhakti and how to get up to that rasa. Okay. So for us, we usually study the first part, this Purva Vibhava, the eastern section, because that's what we're interested in now. But we should never forget that the goal is the other part. And even though we haven't attained rasa or prema or whatever, in order to attain, we also have to have some understanding of it.
So that's described in the
other parts of the work. Three other parts of the work. Okay. So that, we have these different sections. So the eastern section gives the types of bhakti, sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, prem bhakti. Southern section is the ingredients of rasa. We need rasa is a mixture of different things. So all the ingredients come together and they produce rasa. So they'll discuss the different ingredients of rasa. And then western section is the primary rasas, like shanta, dasya, sakya, vasalya, panurya. And northern is the secondary rasas, like hasya, virya, etc. Seven secondary rasas. So it's very systematically laid out. So we shouldn't be too confused by the work. So we were studying the eastern section, as I said, and here actually today we're not going to go through the full eastern section, we're just going to go through the first part. The eastern section is divided up into four parts. Samanya bhakti, or bhakti in general, this is the definition of bhakti, what is pure bhakti, the types of bhakti, etc. The other three parts deal with sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, and prem bhakti. So very consistently the work is planned out. So, what we'll talk about today is based on the definition of bhakti. What is bhakti? Because if we don't have a definition to begin with, it's very difficult to do anything. How can we describe rasa or anything unless we have a very basic definition of bhakti? So this is a very important thing to understand. What is bhakti? If we don't understand that, how can we execute bhakti? So, works, Sanskrit works, begin with an introduction, and the introduction begins with Mangalacharan, which means invoking auspiciousness. So usually auspiciousness is invoked by invoking the Supreme Lord. And the subject of this work, of course, is Bhakti Rasa, but Bhakti Rasa is manifested completely in the relationship with Krishna. So actually, the main work is about Krishna, not about Vishnu or Narasimha Dev or Ramchandra. They all have rasa, of course, but mainly it's about Krishna. So because he's a Swayam Bhagavan, and he manifests all rasas completely. So therefore, he becomes the subject of the work. So the first verse indicates this, that actually Krishna is rasa. So, Akila Rasa Mrita Murti. Krishna is the very form of all sweet rasas. Akila Rasa Mrita Murti. Which means he is the complete manifestation of all the primary rasas, Shanta, Dasya, Sakya, Vasalya, Madhurya, and the seven secondary rasas, like Hasya, Abhuta, Virya, Vibhatsa, etc. So these manifest completely in Krishna. And he, when it says Rasa Mrita Murti, that means his very form is rasa. So that's the essence of Krishna, rasa. So, then it describes his relationships, and these relationships here are all Madhurya Rasa. Of course, he has relationships in Sakya and Vasali and Dasya and Santa, etc. But Madhurya Rasa is chosen because that's the highest rasa. It manifests everything completely in the most intense form. So he's chosen Madhurya Rasa. And in Madhurya Rasa, we also have degrees of intensity. So he starts from the general and gets down to the most intense relationship. Prasimra Ruchi Ruda, Taraka Pali Kalita, Shamalalita, Radha Prayam, Vidur Jayati. So he starts from the more indirect relationships with some gopis, like Taraka and Palika, and then a more direct relationship with Shama and Lalita, who embrace Krishna, and then finally the relationship with Radha, who actually controls Krishna. So in this way he describes a rasa in terms of Madhurya Rasa, and in Madhurya Rasa we have various types of relationships also. So rasa is full of all sorts of varieties. So, the Madhurya Rasa is considered supreme, just as we have various juices. You may have sugarcane juice, grape juice, musambi juice. What else do we have?
Pomegranate juice.
Mango juice. So though they're all sweet and people have different preferences, most people will choose mango juice. So like that, Madhurya Rasa is like the mango juice, and then we have the other rasas. They're all like, you know, pomegranate juice or sugarcane juice. I've never had various intensities and particular qualities in them. But the highest one, the most complete one, the most nourishing one is Madhurya Rasa. Like the mango juice. Okay. So here we just have the various degrees. This, of course, in relation to Radha, because she is the peak of Madhurya Rasa. She's the highest form and the manifestation of Mahabhava. So, in she has her groups. Nobody in the spiritual world is alone. So the gopis particularly work in groups. So they, Radha has her group. And among them we have, of course, the Asasakis, Lalita and Vishaka are the chief ones. So these are mentioned in that verse. That's her own group, Svapaksha. On the opposite side, we have the competitor. That is Chandravali. She's the enemy. Because of the competition there. And she has her group. In the group we have Pali, or Palika, Padma, Savya, and others. So Palika is mentioned there. And in between we have different groups. So we have the Suhit group. Friendly towards Radha. So when there's a competition, they will side with Radha and support her and do things for Radha's group. So in that group, we have Shama. Huh? That was mentioned in the verse. And then we have the Tushra group, which is borderline, but usually they side with the opposite group. Yeah? So they will do things for Chandravali's group. Huh? So we have Taraka and Shama in that group. So in this way, we have various components of Rasa, Madhurya Rasa, and different competitions and things like this. But ultimately, Radha is supreme. So that verse describes the variegatedness of Madhurya Rasa. But very cleverly, the verse also describes the moon in the sky in the spring month of Vaishakh. So the months of India actually are defined in terms of where the moon is situated when it's a Purnima. And it's there's different nakshatras where it's situated. 27 nakshatras are there. So of those, the moon goes into 12 different nakshatras when it's a Purnima or a full moon. Right? So in Vaishakh month, the full moon is in Vaishakh, Vishakha nakshatra. So it's very close to that particular configuration. So Vishakha nakshatra is a very bright constellation in the sky. Very bright. It's a group of stars. And when the moon comes very close to that on the Purnima, it looks very, very beautiful. So that's described here in this verse. Also, the same words which describe Krishna and his relationship with the gopis also describes the moon in relationship with the stars, the blackness of the night, and the rays of the moon covering the other stars so that they're not so bright. So this intensifies the idea of Krishna with the gopis. Vidu means Krishna, but it also means the moon. And the moon also is considered to be the source of rasa. We know that the moon, when it goes through different phases, it stimulates the rasa in plants, and they grow in different amounts according to the phases of the moon. And therefore, we can, there's what we call the almanacs and things like that, according to the phases of the moon, you plant your crops, you harvest your crops, do different things. Cut them or whatever like this, according to moon phases, because the rasa is going up and down according to the moon. So moon is said to be amrita in nature, and it spreads amrita to the plants and everything like that. So it is also akila rasa medamorti, the moon. But of course, secondarily, Krishna is the main source. And then the moon also spreads its light out. Is the bright, more brighter than all the stars, and it eclipses the brightness of many of the stars in the sky. It also embraces the night, the darkness of the night. So this is described in this verse also as a secondary image. To emphasize the beauty of Krishna in relation to all the gopis. Okay. There's a few other verses in the introduction. Rupa Goswami offers his respect, as he always does in all of his works, to his elder brother. Because his brother was elder, he offers his respects to him and offers as a guru, more or less. And
even though Rupa Goswami was more prolific, he wrote many, many works. Snati Goswami wrote one or two works. Rupa Goswami offers his respects always to Snati Goswami and the other devotees, because it is essential that we get the blessings of devotees for our success. Yeah? So no one is ever alone. As I said, the gopis are never alone. They're always in groups. So also the devotees should act in groups and get the blessings of other devotees for all their endeavors. So Rupa Goswami asks for the blessings of Sanatana Goswami and the devotees. And he compares the devotees to Makara. Sometimes we translate that as sharks, but actually sharks are not very nice creatures. They're non-vegetarian and they're very violent sometimes. They like to devour people. So the Makara is actually a very strange animal, something we haven't seen. He's got an elephant trunk and he's got bird feet and he's got six different elements of different animals in him. But he's considered to be the king of the fish. He is also the emblem for Cupid or love. So Rupa Goswami compares the devotees to Makaras because they are the king of the fish and therefore they're very skillful at swimming in the ocean of rasa. So similarly, the devotees are also skillful at swimming in the ocean of rasa. So these Makara, because they're so proficient and strong in the ocean, they can dive very deeply into the ocean of rasa. Consequently, because they go so deep, they can avoid the nets of the fishermen. And the nets of the fishermen are the nets of karma and time in the material world. So therefore, their devotees, by absorbing themselves in rasa, become free from material entanglement. And these makara are so absorbed in the deep ocean of rasa that they avoid the rivers that flow into the ocean. The rivers are related to the ocean, and we say the waters flow into it, but the rivers are also shallow, and they're not as fulfilling, satisfying as the ocean. So what are the rivers? Five types of liberation. Sayujya, Sarupya, Sarsti, Samipya. So, in other words, the devotees are not interested in attaining spiritual planet, spiritual form, everything like that. They're interested simply in serving Krishna and getting the rasa from that. Of course, Krishna, by his nature, awards the devotee spiritual body, spiritual place, etc. But that's not the aspiration of the devotees. They're absorbed in service. So this is a very nice description of the devotees of the Lord. There's another mantra over there. And Rupa Goswami also compares the criticizers, those who were absorbed in karma, karma-mimamsikas, or purva-mimamsikas, that meaning as group, who were absorbed in sacrifices to go to Svarga-loka, and they don't think anything is spiritual, nothing beyond that. And the gyanis, who think that liberation is the goal, but no rasa, no form of the Lord, no activities of the Lord, no relationship with the Lord, just to become Brahman. So we have these two groups of people who will attack the concept of rasa and relationship with Krishna and bhakti yoga. So he prays that this work will stop the criticisms of these people. It will defeat their attempts to find happiness in Svarga Loka or Brahman. How? By displaying the greater ananda that we get through serving Krishna in bhakti rasa. So he compares those criticizers to the fire in the ocean, is what's called the Madhava fire. That is a fire somehow, situated somewhere in the ocean, and pops up and spurts out fire. So the ocean of rasa should drown that fire. It should drown the criticisms of the karmis and the yogis and the gyanis. So now we come to the actual definition, pure bhakti. This is bhakti, uttama bhakti. Uttama means, of course, the highest bhakti. It also means uttama means beyond tamas. And so, transcendental bhakti, or pure bhakti, or spiritual bhakti, whatever. We have other names for this, akinchana bhakti, bhakti without any attachments, or sudha bhakti, pure bhakti. There's several different names that we can use. So here it's called uttama bhakti. So the definition is given in this second line, anukulyena krishnanusilanam.
So the main subject here, what is bhakti? It is Krishna Anusilana. Anusilana means a cultivation. So it means a cultivation of a relationship with Krishna. And this is made in particular by the word anukulina. Anukulina means favorable. So with favorableness, which means not with hatred, but rather with a liking for the Supreme Lord, with affection for the Supreme Lord, we establish and cultivate a relationship. So that's the basic meaning of bhakti. To establish and cultivate a favorable relationship with Krishna. That cultivation takes two forms, Chesta Rupa and Bhava Rupa. In the beginning of bhakti, the Chesta Rupa, or the service, the activities, external activities, are very prominent. When we come to Bhava and Prema, Bhava Rupa Bhakti, or the emotional aspect, becomes very prominent. So both aspects are important, but in the beginning stages, we concentrate on the Chesta Rupa Bhakti. So we do different activities involving our senses and minds, etc., chanting, hearing, deity worship, etc. This is all Chesta Rupa Bhakti. When the Stai Bhava arises, that is, we discover a relationship, Dasya, Satya, Vatsalya relationship, this becomes stronger and stronger, and in Bhava, we realize Krishna in that relationship. So that becomes Bhava Rupa Bhakti. Nevertheless, a person who has Bhava and Prema continues Chesta Rupa also. He also serves the Lord. So Chesta Rupa is also not given up. But in Bhava and Prema, the Bhava Rupa becomes quite prominent also. So that's the Anusilana. We cultivate a relation internally. That becomes Bhava and Prema. And we also cultivate using senses and maya and sadhana bhakti. Okay? It says Krishna Anusilana, then we may say, well, okay, bhakti means only to Krishna and to nobody else. But this word Krishna is used to include all the forms of the Lord, because since Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan, everything is included in Krishna. So therefore, if you worship Ramchandra, that's also Uttama Bhakti. Or if you worship Nrsimhadeva, also Uttama Bhakti. But primarily, we're interested in Krishna because he contains all rasas fully, so therefore we mentioned the word Krishna. But it could be bhakti for any of the avatar forms of the Lord also. And we can say it's bhakti also, and pure bhakti as well. So, now a discussion of the word anukulina, with favorableness. Some people may interpret this to mean favorableness means that we do activities and they're pleasing to the Lord, then that's what we call favorable. However, there's some problem with that, because we see that Radhikasipu fought with Nrsimhadeva, not a devotee, and he fought with hatred. But when he fought with Nrsimhadeva was very pleased, because he likes to fight. He likes to display virya rasa. He likes to kill the demons to protect his devotees. So even though Hiranyakasipu was a demon, Nrsimhadeva was very pleased with his inimical attitude, because he had got the opportunity to fight with them. So in this case, the Lord was pleased with the act of Hiranyakasipu fighting, but it wasn't bhakti on the part of Hiranyakasipu. So just because something is pleasing to the Lord doesn't mean that it's bhakti. On the other hand, we find great devotees may sometimes anger the Lord. So Yasoda, who's Nitisid, a perfect devotee in Vatsalya Rasa, and can never make a mistake. She was feeding Krishna from her breast, and then she heard the milk boiling over in the kitchen, and she put Krishna down, and she ran into the kitchen to take the milk off the fire, because she was trying to serve Krishna. And what did Krishna do? Got angry. So Mother Yasoda's act of taking the milk off the fire is bhakti, but Krishna got angry. So therefore, it wasn't pleasing to Krishna, but we can't say that Mother Yasoda's act of taking the milk off the fire was not bhakti. It was bhakti. Definitely. So,
simply if it's pleasing or displeasing to Krishna does not make it.
So, therefore, we have to look for another definition. So the other definition is anukulyena means with intention on the part of the devotee to please Krishna. So, Pranikasa would never have any intention of pleasing the Lord. He wanted to kill him. So therefore, automatically, that's not devotion. So that fits there. And as for Mother Yasoda, she always has an intention of pleasing Krishna, even if Krishna becomes angry. So therefore, that definition fits both scenarios of Mother Yasoda and Pranikasipu. It excludes Pranikasipu, it includes Mother Yasoda. So therefore, anukulyena means, on the part of the devotee, he intends to please Krishna. Even if Krishna is not happy or whatever, still, the devotee has an intention of pleasing Krishna. So that is what anukulyena means.
Okay.
So, this is made more particular by the first line, Anya Abhilasha Jasunya Jnana Karma Jnanavartam. It should be devoid of desires other than desire to please the Lord. Anya Abhilasha Jasunya, devoid of other desires. So, what are these other desires? Who can have a desire for? Material benefits. In other words, we can do the bhakti, but we can think, you know, I want to please Krishna, but I also want some benefits for myself. I want to get a good house, I want to get a good car, and I'll do my bhakti for that also. So this is not pure bhakti. There's other desires. Or, if one is more advanced, maybe, one will think, oh, I don't want anything in the material world, but I want to get liberation. So we mix our bhakti, and at the same time we're trying to escape from the material problems of the material world and get liberated, give up gross and subtle material bodies. So that is our aim also. It mixes and dilutes the bhakti. So that is a mixture of jnana, impersonal jnana. So both of these are unfavorable. We can have other mixtures also, yoga, etc., desire to get siddhis or something like that, and mix that in with our bhakti. So that also is not approved. So therefore he says it should be generally free of other desires, and unobstructed by jnana, karma, etc. He doesn't say jnana, karma, sunya. And the reason is that some types of jnana are favorable to bhakti, and some are necessary for bhakti. So Bhagavad jnana, Sambandha jnana are necessary for bhakti. So that jnana is not excluded. It doesn't obstruct bhakti. It increases the bhakti. So when we read Bhagavatam, that is Bhagavad Jnana, not impersonal Jnana. So that is permitted. And as for karma, that we don't exclude all activities, we exclude those activities in the scripture which aim at material enjoyment. That's the karma kanda section of the Vedas. Do sacrifices to go to Svarga Loka. Do punyas in order to avoid sin and have a next life which is very comfortable, etc. So that's definitely we avoid. Other activities, we do activities in bhakti, those we don't avoid. And we can even do some of the karma yoga activities if they support our activities in bhakti. So we borrow many of our activities from varnashram system, standards of cleanliness we take from there. Guhastha rules for grasta life, marriage ceremony, samskaras, we take from the karma yoga section. And they're not contradictory to bhakti, they're favorable for our devotional development, so we also accept this. So we don't reject karma completely. Some things, of course, we have to be careful of. So something like Shraddha rites, which involves worship of pitras. So that is obstructive to bhakti, because we're only supposed to worship Supreme Lord, not the pitras. So if the Shraddha advice of all that, we have to avoid that. We can't just say worship the pitras. We can modify the pitra rites and only worship Vishnu or Krishna. And then it's fine, we can do that. So we should also not feel obligated that we must do these Shraddha rites. And if I don't, I'm sinful. We can do them with the attitude, I will do them simply not to disturb my parents or other people because I'm criticized they were being adharmic or something. And we do them, but we do them all without attachment, that's all. For certain reasons. So we shouldn't be too attached to the karmas. We can do them simply to put a show on for people. That's all. Mm-hmm. So that way,
we can do some karmas also. The word anya abhilashata sunyam is used. Abhilashata, not as abhilashunyam, but abhilashata. So that's also explained. Abhilasa sunyam would mean completely devoid of other desires. And abhilashata means generally devoid of other desires. So why it's mentioned is because sometimes the devotee may have desires. So the example is given, if you're in danger and you say, Krishna save me. So then someone says, you're not in pure bhakti anymore because you have your desire to ask Krishna to save you. So then the answer is no, this is not a permanent desire. It's happened once because one is in danger, one asks for Krishna. So therefore, periodically, if the devotee asks for something for Krishna, that does not make him a practicer of impure bhakti. Yeah? So some exceptions are allowed. Yeah? One cannot pray for getting out of danger. So it's not a constant prayer. It is a one-time affair. So therefore, that's also acceptable. So therefore, in general, without desires. Okay. So we're talking about this pure bhakti. It is this pure bhakti, uttama bhakti, which will progress into bhava and then into prema. And then we get rasa, which is the main subject of the work. If we do not do this pure bhakti, we do not get that result. So that is why we have to practice pure bhakti. Of course, we say, well, I got so many desires, whatever. But this is pure bhakti, we'll see, has three types: sadhana, bhava, and prema. Prema is the only 100% pure bhakti one, and literally speaking, bhava maybe 98% or something. And then sadhana will be less than that. 10%, 20%, 30%, 50%, 80%, you know, like this. And then what is the other percent? 10% or 20%? Never mind. So in the process of bhakti, in sadhana, we're not pure. Nevertheless, we still call this process uttama bhakti, pure bhakti. Because it's only with this we'll get to the pure stage of prema. So, what does this mean then? That means that we're going through a process. We're not pure, absolutely, but we're practicing according to the definition as much as possible. We understand that when we're practicing bhakti, we're not asking for things, etc. Subconsciously, of course, you may have some attachments or whatever, but we're trying to practice and serve Krishna. We're not asking for things from him, liberation or material things. So, therefore, when we're doing sadhana, we also call this pure bhakti. For that reason, it's a sadhana to attain the real pure bhakti and prema. So, it's only with this type of attitude that we can get to that stage of pure bhakti and develop rasa in the spiritual world. If we mix our bhakti with some jnana, a desire for liberation and freedom from material stresses, etc., we can progress more than the karmi, obviously, because bhakti is very strong, and we can get more than the gyan, who gets liberation. So if we get more than liberation, what do we get? At least we get the spiritual world. But we don't develop the highest rasas. We'll get some form of shanta rasa. A weak relationship with the Lord, because in our practice, the jnana diluted the bhakti. Mixture of jnana, jnana mr. bhakti, will lead us up into the spiritual world, but we end up with a shantarasa relationship with the Lord. So we get a distinct difference. Now, we can do bhakti with karma, some material desires attached as well. This is also better than karma yoga, because it's mostly bhakti. In karma yoga, we have a little bhakti also, or no bhakti. If we have no bhakti at all, karma yoga is useless. It doesn't give anything. If we have karma yoga with a little bhakti, we recognize Vishnu or Krishna as supreme. But we sometimes worship, not all the time. And we're mainly interested in material assets. We can get our assets. We can get to Svargaloka, etc. by the force of bhakti. But we can't get spiritual world. So, if we do bhakti with a little karma, we can also surpass all the karma yogis and get better than Brahmaloka. And
We can get better than liberation, even if we can get better than the Gyanis. So we can also go to the spiritual world. But again, we don't get Rasa, we get Salokya, Sarsti, Sarupya, all these things. And you can be very happy with your form and powers in the spiritual world because you have some desire for enjoyment in your bhakti. So you get the spiritual. Of course, in the spiritual world, you no longer have material desires. But because you had a desire in the material world, the Lord likes to reward you in this way. And your bhakti was not strong as pure bhakti. So therefore, you get the spiritual world, the spiritual body. But the relationship is indirect. You may serve the Lord in meditation. And you don't develop these higher rasas, dasya, sakya, etc. So that is why we cannot mix our bhakti with these things explicitly. We may have desires, you know, the jiva has desires, mind has desires, but when we do the bhakti, we try to avoid all these things. Then we can attain this rasa, this spiritual world. Like that. No? So, we have three types of uttama bhakti: sadhana, bhava, and prema. They're all bhakti. The same activities continue. We do chesta rupa bhakti and sadhana, it's very prominent. And we continue to do activities in bhava. The bhava bhakta, he also chants, he also worships the Lord, he also hears, he does these activities, and in prema bhakti also. So the activities are never given up, they continue. In fact, bhakti is the only eternal process. Karma is not eternal. Jnana is not eternal. The Jnani, when he gets liberation, gives up the practice of Jnana. He no longer studies Vedanta. The devotee will continue. In prema, we see in Lord Chaitanya among the associates, they're always hearing Bhagavatam, they're always chanting, they're always doing devotional activity. So in prema, one continues the activities of bhakti. That means the activities of bhakti are eternal. They're not temporary. We begin at a certain stage. We say, they're temporary, they have a beginning. But actually, no. The bhakti descends from the spiritual world into the jiva. So the bhakti is actually eternal. And it manifests within the jiva. And he begins his activities that look like it's temporary. But actually, it's eternal. So bhakti is quite different from all the other processes. So it has these three distinct stages. The goal of sadhana is bhava, which means sthayi bhava. We establish a relationship with the Lord as dasya, sakya, vasaya, madhurya. It's not complete, and therefore it's like flowers opening up a little bit. And when it becomes completely opened up, it's called prema, which means full manifestation of the rasa in our relationship with Krishna. And sadhana, like a bhakti. We do the activities of bhakti, Krishna has not appeared. So the goal of sadhana is to get to the next stage, bhava. When bhava appears, that means Krishna manifests himself really directly. So we do sadhana to attain the bhava. When we do get to bhava stage, then we proceed to prema. No more sadhana. That doesn't mean we stop hearing and chanting, but it's not called sadhana anymore. It's called bhava. And we're doing it because of bhava. The relationship with the Lord inspires us to hear and chant and serve, etc. And that produces prema, full manifestation. So we have these three distinct stages. And they're all called uttama bhakti or pure bhakti. Even though the first two stages are not really pure, there is some contamination. Still we call pure bhakti because these lead to the stages of prema. Okay. In this chapter also, Rupa Goswami discusses the unique features of bhakti, or six qualities, which gradually manifest. Klesha kni, and suvada, moksha lubhuta krit, sudralama, sandranada visheshatma, and Sri Krishna karshan. These are the six qualities. So, first quality. Klesha kni. Kni comes from the word han, a verb which means to kill or destroy. And it takes the form of kni. Klesha means suffering. And so this word klesha is often used. In Patanjali, he uses the word klesha also to describe our material maya, entanglement, etc.
So klesha refers directly to the suffering we get in terms of sickness and death, like all these things. It also refers to the causes of the suffering. So we define three causes of suffering. This is generally accepted even by the Mayavadis and other people as well. So suffering has a cause. What is the cause of suffering? Simple activity. We do some activities that cause the suffering, and then we get a karma in the future. What is the cause of our sinful activity? Desires. We have a great desire for a certain type of enjoyment, so we disregard the rules of Dharma, and we just do the activity in a sinful way, and then we get this suffering. Why do we have these desires for enjoyment? Because of ignorance, avidya. What does avidya mean? That means we do not recognize ourselves as jiva, as a servant of the Supreme Lord. That we should serve the Supreme Lord. We think I should be happy, but separate from anybody else. So therefore we develop desires for our own enjoyment. And then the desires lead to actions, the actions lead to suffering. So we have these stages. So, bhakti is kleshagni. It destroys all of these kleshas. From the suffering to the cause of the suffering, which was the sinful actions, which caused by the desires, caused by the avidya, which is the root. So all of this is destroyed by the process of bhakti. So we have these avidya. We separate ourselves. We think I am independent. And I want to enjoy, and then we develop from that. If I don't get my desires fulfilled, I hate this person, or I fear this person, or whatever. Then we do violent acts and destroy things and whatever. So this is how we go on in the material world. So a desire is actually manifested in two forms. I want something because it's pleasurable. I don't want something because it's painful. Pleasure and pain. Two basic things. And all day long, your mind will be judging things in terms of this is good, this is bad, because this gives me pleasure, this gives me pain, this is bad, this gives me pleasure, this is good. And I do activities to get the good things, I do activities to avoid the bad things. So all of our desires, all of our actions are determined all day long by this concept, based on our, I am the body and I want to enjoy. So, very difficult to get. So we call the dualities of ichcha and dvesha, desire and hatred, which cause bondage in the material world. So, when we have the desire, due to ignorance, and then we want to do something, then we may do some activity, which is wrong. We may get an experience, for instance, somebody hits you and you get pain. Then your reaction is, I have to take revenge or defend myself so you hit the other person. Okay, that's your action. I respond to some attack on myself. I don't like the pain, so I respond to some other action of giving out somebody else pain. We may not get the result in this lifetime. Sometimes we do. Other people will attack us, or we may have to go to jail, or so many things will happen. But sometimes it doesn't happen. So this will lead a reaction in a future lifetime. We get born again, and then we come up, and then we have to get that reaction. According to the amount of pain we inflict on others, we have to get the result, if it is done simply, not according to Dharma. So, in a future lifetime, then we get the reaction of pain. And so that is the karma. So, once we commit the act, then the karma goes on, but it may have stages. It doesn't manifest immediately. It may not manifest even in the next lifetime. It may be 20 lifetimes later you get the result for some activity you've done 20 lifetimes before. So there's a gradual manifestation of the result of your sin, not immediate. So therefore it's classified in four stages. Aparabdha, Kuta, Bija, and Parabdha. Parabdha means I experience it. I get the accident and I get the pain. That's Aparabdha. Bija is coming up in this lifetime sometime. So we may have a slight awareness that it's going to happen. Sometimes people have premonitions, or they have a dream that something's going to happen and it happens. So that means it's getting closer. The karmic reaction is surfacing, and it may surface in the subtle body first, and then you may have a dream about it, you may have some feeling this something's not proper, and then it happens. So that's the bija, a very subtle manifestation.
The Kutana Prabha means not in this lifetime at all.
Very subtle.
So very difficult to trace these out. They'll happen in future lifetimes. Of the two, the Kuta is slightly manifested.
So you may have a premonition of your next lifetime and something's happening then even.
That would be a Kuta. And Aparabdha, you don't even know about it. So therefore, all the activities will go through these stages. Unmanifested, slightly manifested, more manifested than experiencing in this lifetime. Okay? So, process of bhakti destroys all of these stages of the karma. Plus it destroys the desire, plus it destroys the ignorance. All levels get destroyed by the process of bhakti. And the interesting thing is, even without bhakti, they can get destroyed by accidentally doing the bhakti. So we have the case of Ajamil. He didn't want to do bhakti. He named his son Narayana. And by calling the name Narayana, accidentally, meaning the name of the Lord, all of his karmas disappeared. Past, present, future. Parabdha, aparabdha, kuta, bija, all got destroyed. Accidentally chanting the name of Narayana. So therefore, bhakti is a very powerful process. Even if it's done accidentally, it can do this. This, of course, is not our goal, to destroy karmas and all this stuff like that. Otherwise, that's liberation. But it happens very easily, even in namalas, accidental chanting. So this is the unique feature of bhakti. The process of dhyana and the process of yoga, it takes a long, long time to destroy the subtle karmas in the subtle body. And only after a long, long time they can get liberation because they haven't destroyed these karmas. Whereas bhakti, very quickly, karmas can disappear. So this is one unique feature of bhakti. So there's this show the gradual manifestation for upper up to put the bija to finally experiencing the pain or whatever. Okay. So how are these destroyed? When we practice bhakti, it is said that the parabdha is first to go, then the bija, then the kuta, then the aparabdha. So it goes from the gross to the subtle, as we perceive in the bhakti. However, as we see, it can also be, if we have no offense, even accidental bhakti can completely destroy these karmas, as in the case of Ajamila. If we have some offense, then we'll go to the gradual stage, the parabdha, bija, kuta, aparabdha. So, that's the negative side. The positive side is subhada. So one, we destroy all the bad things, the karmas and desires, etc. The other is subhada. One thing about this destruction of karmas, destruction of desires, and destruction of avidya. So, karma yoga, what does it do? It actually manipulates your karmas, so you get more good karmas. But it doesn't destroy your karmas completely, so you never get free of suffering. You're always in karma. You go to Brahmaloka, you still have karma. So karma yoga doesn't get rid of your karmas at all. Jnana and Astanga yoga, finally to get liberation, you can get rid of your karmas. Yeah? You also get rid of your desires, and you also get rid of your avidya, and you enter into that stage. However, it's a long, long process. In the process of bhakti, as that even Ajamil got all of his karmas destroyed immediately, etc. So, it's quite a remarkable process. And the Jnanis and the Yogis will say, you cannot destroy your prabdha karmas. You have to wait until they're all finished, and then your body's finished, and then you're free. Whereas bhakti says, even your prabdha karmas are destroyed in this lifetime. So, very unique process. Okay, so, subhada, manifestation of auspiciousness or good qualities. These are enumerated in different ways. Jagat prinam, affection for all of the entities. The devotee develops compassion. This is not material compassion of sattva-guna. It's sattva-guna binding. So, subhada means spiritual compassion like Krishna. Krishna has great compassion for the living entities. He wants to deliver for the material world through the process of bhakti. So the jiva also develops compassion, trying to deliver jivas by giving them bhakti. Jagatam anurakta, he becomes attracted to all living entities. Living entities become attracted to the devotees because of their bhakti. Sadguna means developing good qualities. Of course, affection for all living entities is a good quality anyway. But they're placed separately to show the
outstanding nature. But one develops all good qualities, such as qualities of devatas, etc. But these qualities, again, are not material qualities, they're not supplement qualities, they're actually spiritual qualities. Krishna has 64 qualities. Jiva can develop 50 qualities. But they're spiritual qualities, not material qualities. And in fact, developing good qualities of sattva-guna are not part of bhakti, according to Rupa Goswami. These qualities develop naturally with the development of bhakti. By association with Krishna, we also develop Krishna's nice qualities. So, these, of course, like Kleshadini, as we do the sadhana, they can gradually manifest. These qualities can also manifest. And in prema, we have all the qualities manifested fully. Another type of auspiciousness is sukha, happiness. What we get sukha from bhoga, material enjoyment, or from liberation, those we reject. The other type of happiness is the happiness of bhakti. When that becomes intensified, it becomes ananda in bhava, and it becomes sandrananda, condensed bliss in prema. And in the sadhana stage, we call it sukha, we don't call it ananda, but there is the satisfaction of the jiva from the performance of bhakti, even in sadhana. Okay. So therefore, subhadha refers to the happiness, which gradually intensifies as we go through the bhakti process. Okay. So, these two are like the first manifestations in bhakti. Subhadha, kleshikne, destruction of karmas, good qualities appearing. These happen in sadhana bhakti. These two manifestations are in sadhana bhakti. In bhava bhakti, we have the second two manifestations, moksha, laguta, kriti, disinterest in the bliss of liberation. Why? It's because in bhava stage, we get to meet Supreme Lord. We get to experience ananda. So therefore, the bliss of simply destroying your material body is considered insignificant. Because we have higher bliss of a relationship with Krishna. So therefore, moksha is considered useless, insignificant. At the stage of bhava, ahankara is all destroyed, karma is destroyed even by the end of sakti. And in bhava stage, the desires and the ahankara are completely destroyed. So by nature, bhakti does this without any extra endeavor. Whereas the jnani or the yogi, they have to strive and strive and strive to destroy all the desires and the ahankara, etc. So it naturally happens simply by the development of bhakti. So the liberation is already achieved for the devotee. But he goes beyond that and develops a relationship with the Lord. So therefore, moksha is considered insignificant. So dulama, very rarely attained. What this means, of course, is that the jnani or the yogi or the karmi can never meet the Lord. They never get a direct vision of the Lord, no matter how long they practice. It is only through the process of bhakti that you can develop and realize the Supreme Lord. He will not reveal himself to others. And secondly, we have to go through the process. Sadhana bhakti, go to nishtha, ruchi, sakti, and bhava. And then in bhava, we can see the Lord. So sadhana bhakti is not so rare. We have many people doing it. To get to bhava is rare, because we have to go through this whole process. And even if we go through the process, we cannot determine when Krishna is going to reveal himself. He'll reveal himself when he likes to. That's all. So we cannot predict by, because I've done so much sadhana, then Krishna must reveal himself. I've done it so long, therefore Krishna has to reveal. No. It's up to Krishna only. We cannot determine when. So in that sense, it's rare. Prema. Now when bhava proceeds to prema, the ananda intensifies to a high degree, condensed bliss, and therefore, of course, liberation is considered useless again. But one never gives up the relationship with the Lord because of that intense bliss. That one is permanently bound to the Lord at that stage. So, there's bliss in various degrees. Bhava, we get more bliss, and then prema, we get all the bliss. So, that's the degrees. And Krishna Karshani, the last one, appears in prema. Krishna becomes attracted to that bhakti, prema. So much so
that he falls under the control of the devotees. He's willing to do anything for the devotees.
So Krishna's not attracted to yoga, to sangha, to dharma, to study of the Vedas, to austerities, or renunciation, but he is attracted to bhakti. Of course, he's attracted to sadhana bhakti, or even a person with faith, and therefore he makes arrangements for all these people. But when one attains the prema, the perfection of bhakti, pure bhakti with no delusion of any other desire, then Supreme Lord falls under control of the devotees. This is so not only for Krishna, for Vishnu, etc. So we see the case of Vishnu in relation to Ambarish. That's that he's I'm the servant of my devotee. My devotee says, okay, no offense of Durvasa, then okay, then it's fine. But I cannot do anything. My devotee's in charge. So even for Vishnu, he mentions he's under the control of the devotee. So, but with Krishna, it becomes even more remarkable. So Krishna is under the control of Mother Yasoda, and she ties him up. Nobody ties Krishna up. Nobody ties Ramchandra up. Nobody ties Vasudeva up. But Krishna gets tied up. So remarkable, Krishna falls under the control of the devotees. It's most remarkable. So, therefore, we have these six unique qualities, which two manifest in sadhana bhakti, and they continue to progress through bhava and prema. The second two manifest during bhava, and the third two during prema, like that. So the first two. So that means that in prema, all six manifest completely in the most intense forms, whereas in sadhana, we get the first two manifesting slightly more in bhava and completely in prema. And in bhava, we get two extra. They also manifest completely in prema. So the prema has six qualities manifested completely. Okay, at the end of this chapter, then Rupa Goswami says, the qualification for understanding bhakti, for understanding Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, is ruchi, not tarka. Tarka means intellect, logic. Of course, we can say that we have to use intellectual abilities to understand scripture, definitely. You need intelligence to understand what a word means and how the word relates to another word, what a sentence means, how the sentence relates to another sentence, what a paragraph's subject matter is, etc., what the conclusion is. So we have to use our intelligence and logic, definitely. So what this means is that the logic should not be independent. In other words, we should not speculate on what the meaning is. We should try to get the meaning according to what the scripture says. So our logic should follow after the scriptural conclusions. Now we invent some new conclusion. So if we try to understand bhakti, we have to do it through the scriptures with faith. And if we try to approach Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu with this logic and no faith, then we're bound to come up with wrong conclusions and whatever. So we have to start with faith and devotion. Then we can understand, we can use our logic, but it's based upon this bhakti. So it's good for the devotees, we can understand this work. For the materialists, no, they cannot understand properly. Okay. So logic is criticized because it's relative. A person who's more skillful at logic can defeat another person. Doesn't mean it's a correct conclusion, but simply because the logical process is more skillful, he can defeat somebody. So in this way, a conclusion is established. With logic, we can defeat that, establish a new conclusion. Someone more skillful, he can defeat that, and we get a new conclusion. So logic is insubstantial. It's continually defeated by another more skillful person. So it's useless. So we have to go by these scriptural conclusions. And what's said in scripture, that is the basis. And then logically, we can use our brain to come to the correct conclusion, figure out the meaning properly. So logic is not useless, but it is in pursuance of the scriptural conclusion. Okay, that's it. Finished.
Questions?
Yeah, questions?
Maharaj. Maharaj, you mentioned in the lecture that if one is doing bhakti with karma and jnana mixed, then one gets a bit... not the perfection that is expected.
Rasa
that is expected. But Maharaj, our constitutional position is same, right? So can it happen that I may end up with the shant bhava, but my constitutional position may be in some other rasa.
That's not discussed. What is discussed is your sadhana determines your goal. Just as in school, if you take engineering, you get an engineering degree, not a medical degree. Or if you study arts, you get an arts degree, not a science degree. So, in sadhana bhakti, according to our efforts, we get a result according to that. So if I worship Krishna, I realize Krishna, not Vishnu or Ramchandra or something like that. And according to rasa, if I worship Krishna, of course the other forms, no choice. It's all dasya rasa. It's only with Krishna there's the actual choice between rasas. So if we worship Krishna, then you also have a choice of rasa. So if your sadhana, your sadhana become absorbed in a relationship, let's say, of sakya, then that's what you realize. And if you realize something else finally, then you would be disappointed. You say, what? You're trying to realize a relationship with Krishna, friendly rasa, and suddenly you're in that Madhurya rasa, you'll say, we can't. So this way, the sadhana determines the bhava and prema results, which is natural. Yeah? We wouldn't expect something different. We concentrate in one way, and our mind is fixed in that way. The atma develops a condition of loving in that way. That's what we attain.
So Maharaj, one clarification I want here. So is it that we make it to that place, or is it that that is our constitutional position?
Well, it doesn't really matter, because when you attain that perfection in the spiritual world, so that is perfect. So in that sense, it's constitutional.
Precautions one has to take which leads to the right goal of sadhana bhakti. How one has to do sadhana bhakti to reach to next level?
Oh, as I said, we have to do this according to this definition. Anya abhilashas, anya jnana karma, anya avartam, anukunena krishna siram. As much as possible, as doing in our sadhana, we have to avoid desires for material enjoyment, asking Krishna for material things, and having desire for liberation.
Many people come to Krishna consciousness on various programs. So, sadhana bhakti, everybody can practice with him. Everybody will be able to practice what is this definition, but they will be able to give him some platform to come to it.
Well, that is an individual thing. Our standard is pure bhakti, because only with that you can get to prema. Some people may not be able to attain that, and therefore in Bhagavad says, with desires or with no desires, or with the desire for liberation, anyway, worship the Lord. But, it says that, but again, if we want to get to pure bhakti in the spiritual world, we have to practice as pure bhakti now. So, people can start that way, but we have to encourage them to give up. So yes, people have desires, so sometimes we'll say, okay, you chant Hare Krishna, solve all your problems. So basically, it's not pure bhakti, but we encourage people that way in the beginning, because so many people are suffering in the material world. So either you do the bhakti and then you can solve all your problems like that. So there's nothing wrong with doing that, but we understand that actually in doing the bhakti we should not have desires for these material, getting rid of suffering or getting material benefits.
Everybody can do guidance and
proper guidance. Yeah. It depends on association, basically. And through association we get proper knowledge and then we can do things properly.
So in the beginning it is not wrong to bring the people to the folds of bhakti.
This is what we call indirect preaching and outreach preaching and things like that. We attract them with prasadam or peace of mind or so many things like that. Yoga or whatever. Stress relief. They go to the corporates and we have stress relief programs. So this is basically indirect preaching to lead them into pure bhakti eventually.
In the beginning, this will bring them to Krishna consciousness. anything is all made. But at the later time, the training has to be given to actually make that. Desires to desire to love Krishna.
But is it okay for a student to ask for a good man?
Well, yeah, if it's only for the service of Krishna, although how the good marks would serve Krishna, I don't know. You get good marks so you can pass your exam so you can join the temple. But if it's only to get good marks so you get a good job so you get money, then that would be mixed bhakti.
I think we see your devotees, Srila Prabhupada also, they pray for making the service better, like Prabhupada is saying on Jalbhuta that please make my words proper so that the people can understand. So the same way, can a devotee ask for something for doing his service?
But that's permissible, anything for favorable for bhakti. Those things, to improve our service, those things are part of bhakti. So it's actually, how can I improve my service for Krishna? How can I serve you, Lord? So those things are okay. The only, let's say, reservation would be that we use those things for our sense enjoyment, and then it becomes dangerous.
Maharaj, you also told about the limitation with the logic. So is it possible that one can come to the right conclusion using logic? I mean, is logic deficient in its very approach, or is it that?
Yes, we have what is called anuman, and pratyaksha, and sabda, the three types of getting knowledge. And what we say is that, as far as practical world is concerned, we use anuman and pratyaksha in everyday things, so no problem with that. However, they are subject to fault. So we can make mistakes in our sense perception. We can also make mistakes in our logic. And so therefore, even science, which tries to get to the truth, makes mistakes because of wrong observation and wrong conclusions. Their logic is faulty or whatever. So it's not perfect by any means. And therefore, even to discover the truth about material energy is faulty because our perceptions by nature are faulty. In other words, from Bhagavatam we hear that the material elements are so subtle we can't even see them. And we have mind element, which science doesn't know about. So most of the universe is invisible to the scientist. And he's trying to figure out the truth about the universe from what he sees, which is like 1% of the whole thing. How can he come to the truth that way? Difficult. His concept of energy and what is real is very limited. But, so therefore, even with anuman and pratyaksha, limited. If we go to higher perception, that is, if we can see like a yogi sees with the subtle body, then we'll get a higher perception of things. Even that's not perfect, because it's material. Higher than that, of course, would be perceptions of the Atma, the spiritual eye, or from the point of view of Supreme Lord. Then we would have actual basis of truth in terms of what is the material world, etc. So therefore, these logic and sense perception do have their limitations. On the other hand, sabda is perfect knowledge, authorized knowledge. So we simply accept it, but then we have to understand it in a proper way. If we get the wrong conclusion, again, it's useless. So we have to take sabda and get the proper meaning through the proper process, through parampara. Then we get the correct vision of what is real, what is true.
Other duties, if they want to send projects, they can send. They are not going to ask directly.
Well, in the Bhagavatam, of course, many times Prabhupada speaks about the miseries of birth, old age, disease, especially like Kapila section. So, how they are like not against pure existence? Then we get impetus because we want to be free from death. But we want to be like, want to go to the spiritual world. So, how do sections and how we should approach
these sections. And we'll see it's the conclusion of some chapters. It says if you read this chapter, then you get free from, you know, birth and death or whatever like that. So we should understand these are secondary results. They're not the goal of bhakti, but they are secondary things. And it's useful for people who are on a lower level they get some relief by saying, okay, now I can get free from all my problems. So basically it's only for that encouraging people. And that's actually mentioned in the Nectar Devotion. And there are many quotations given for the different types of bhakti and, you know, offering pranams or something and getting free from all your distresses. Or so it's mentioned there that some of these praises of bhakti and the different angas of bhakti are there for people of lesser things. So you may get material benefits or this or that. So we should understand that that's not the highest benefit, but it's there for us to encourage people on the world level.
Like, we hear it, vascular speculation, it should not be, like, it can be used. It's proper. Vascular speculation. Mm-hmm. Not mental speculation is condemned. Vascular speculation is.
Well, we don't call speculation, but philosophical knowledge is there. In other words, Brahma Sutras is basically a logical analysis of statements from the Upanishads, which may be confusing for people. So very logically, it comes out with the proper conclusion of what the statement means. It can't mean this because of this, it can't mean this because of this. The context from previous statements must correlate, therefore it must mean this. So it uses logic to interpret and come up with a conclusion. So logic is not useless, but it has to be used properly and based upon the scriptures. Then it's okay. Yeah. So that's what we call philosophy. We use logic to find the conclusion of scriptures and expand upon that. So that, we say, is our philosophy or theology.
Because
Kuta
Mantra is not very
grossly
manifested.
Yeah.
It may not come in this
life also. Yeah. So Aparabdha also comes in this life. Yeah, so Aparabdha is more subtle. You can never even figure out what it is. Kuta, you may have some inclination. So that means even in this lifetime, you could have an inclination of your karmas of next lifetime. You're going to get bored and so-and-so or something like that. So that would be a Kuta. There's a slight manifestation of the Aparabdha even to your mind. Well, you are what you eat. Or who you associate with, you also become like that. I suppose the people associate with dogs and they look like a dog or something. There's also pictures of people, the husband and wife, after a while they begin to look like each other.
Yes, they associate with each other.
But then the idea is that if you think of something constantly when you're in this lifetime, that can also influence your next body, as in the case of Bharat, thought of a deer, he became a deer. So if you become completely absorbed in one type of activity, that's obviously going to influence your next body. It does a little bit.
What is this? What is this?
Something in Hindi.
What is that? Something about karma, that's actually. Bhakti and karma, of course.
I think he's talking about this idea of mixed bhakti and.
Are you saying that?
So what I said is that if you do mixed bhakti, when you get the spiritual world, of course you continue your mixed bhakti and still have some desires like that. In the spiritual world, no more material desires. The Lord will purify you. But the intensity of the bhakti is less, and you did have that desire for self-enjoyment. So the Lord will fulfill that desire and give you your nice form and nice qualities and nice lifestyle, etc. And you have some bhakti and no material contamination, so you get eternal life, etc. But the bhakti is less intense. That's all. No more material desires at that stage. Karen also. Yeah. Well, if they purify themselves there, they can get. That's what we call Krama Mukti. Yeah. Gradual Mukti. You go through the higher planets up to Brahmaloka, and then from Brahmaloka you can go to a spiritual world. That's another type of liberation, Krama Mukti. For people who do have some material attachments, that's described by Balabhadra Goswami. I think in the
Where is it? Brahma Sutras.
Thank you very much. As we heard in the lecture, there is four types of sinful reactions. Chatitva, Prarabdha, Kobarabdha are gradually destroyed by the process of. And the first thing is, even somebody is trying to bhajan kriya, the Prarabdha reactions are destroyed by only. Sometimes we see also that during the year here that there are some very harsh reactions coming through the levels of some devotees.
Yeah.
It is also explained in the way that Krishna may want to destroy the reactions at once, many simple reactions at once. But is it necessary that if they are destroyed at the very beginning of the bhakti, the bhajan kriya directly, why such kind of reactions also sometimes come to the
devotees? Oh, yeah. Several reasons. One, of course, is that if you can get aparads, the process slows down and everything's not destroyed, so you do get more of some reactions. It is said by the stage of asakti, end of asakti, no more karmas. But then, if you're actually a devotee who does no aparads, it goes much quicker than that. And the other thing is that even though your prarabdha karmas are destroyed, there's still an appearance of karma. As in the case of Ajami, a lot of karmas were destroyed, but still looked like he was a sinful person. He still did sinful activities up until the time he died. But yet, Yamaraj couldn't touch him. So he didn't have any sinful reactions for all those activities he did. So, somehow it looked as if he still had karmas and he was still doing sinful activities, even after he named his son Ryan and chanted the name and got rid of all those karmas. So the explanation is that, yes, all of those karmas were destroyed, but the holy name hides its glories, and therefore there's still an appearance of karma. So there's a pattern. Furthermore, in the explanation of Brahma Sutras, there Baladeva Vijayabhusana says, even from the Prem-Bhakta, he has no more karmas at all, no ahankar or anything, the pattern of karma will be there by the will of the Lord. So he compares it to a piece of silk, and you put the silk near a candle flame, but you don't burn it, but you get it very close so it becomes very hot. Then you take it away, and it looks like silk. You touch it, it just crumbles away. So he says that's the appearance of karma. It's like the silk, which is like silk, but actually is not there. So therefore, for the Prem Bhaktas, even there's an appearance of karma or a pattern of karma. It's not real karma because it's under the Supreme Lord's will, but it looks like karma. So therefore, even the Prem Bhakta may get kicked from a heaven accident or whatever. And if you look at astrological chart, we may predict it also. So there's an appearance of karma even for the Prem Bhakta, but it is not actual karma. It's under the Supreme Lord at that stage.
Then we heard that in the Shantas there is a mixture of bhakti and as well as the karma. But is it necessary that even we see in the case of Prahlad Maharaj, we consider that Prahlad Maharaj is considered to be in the Shantas? But how is it that?
Shanta?
I heard.
Oh no, Dasya.
But that was
Kumaras and Shanta. Kumaras.
But that, I mean, is it necessary that the Shantas? Should be mixed with the bhakti as well as bhakti as well as the jnana. So, but even because
Vashanta rasa is a rasa, so it's part of bhakti. It's a very dilute form of bhakti where the service is minimal. So some sages have this, like Kumaras.
Very
peaceful. But they also get into ecstasy when they see the Lord.
Another question was when we talk about the anukulina. We told her the definition, like we told that it is the intention on the part of the devotee to please the Lord. So, like even in the case of the relationship with the devotee, some devotees have certain intentions to please other devotees. But the other devotee may not be pleased or may take it in other way. So, how is it?
Like, so then, still our intention was good, so therefore. Not fruitless.
We can never go back to Godhead because of our anartas, but Srila Prabhupada said that 10-16 rasa are called regular rasa.
do we go back to God in this lifetime? So how can we have faith that we can go back to God? Well, if we have faith, then the devotee thinks that because I have bhakti and I have the Supreme Lord, it doesn't matter how many lifetimes I'm in this material world, as long as I can continue my bhakti. So he says, it may take me a million lifetimes, but as long as I do bhakti, that is the good fortune. So therefore, I think it's Chitrakirti phrase that whether in heaven or hell, the devotee doesn't care. He doesn't even care to go to Vaikuntha, go to the spiritual world, but he should do bhakti. So he can be in a good position, he can be in a hellish position, doesn't matter. Just do bhakti. And he doesn't aspire even for going to the spiritual world. So therefore, the idea is that bhakti continues. Nyavi karmanasasi panchavaya vividyate. Life after life, the bhakti continues. Unless one commits aparad, then it can decrease or get destroyed. So if you don't commit the aparad, then it continues in its life after life until it becomes completely mature. If we're very enthusiastic and intense, yes, we can do it in one lifetime. We see Ajamil, he was a rascal, but in a few years after he got revived from his death experience, then he was able to go to Vaikuntha. He got prema and went to Vaikuntha. So he did it in a very short period of time. Other persons, by the great mercy of a great devotee like Narada Muni, Margari the Hunter, got bhava in 3 months. So that's Kripa's Altruva City, where we get very quick advancement. But normally, we have to go through the sadhana process, which is a little slower. So you can do it one life, or 20 lifetimes, or 30 lifetimes. But anyway, the devotee doesn't really care as long as he continues his process of devotion, gets association with devotees, etc. Because he understands ultimately it's up to the will of the Lord. And when the Lord thinks you're ready, then he'll take it. One who has the material desires based on his level of advancement, his karma, nature, and due devotional service, he may have to fulfill it. So, will such a devotee get lower form in the spiritual world? Well, as one advances, then with the increase of bhakti, naturally the desires and karma, all these things decrease. Because we see klesha gnani is the structure of karma. And subhada takes place. So, as you do bhakti, as we increase the bhakti, the other things, material aspects increase. And we go through an ajna vrijita nishirishya sakti. So, gradually, the material desires will decrease on their own. But, if we do mixed bhakti, then we kind of encourage those desires. So that is why we're told to do pure bhakti. Let me do my devotional service and not ask for material things. Yes, maybe the desires are there in our mind someplace, but our bhakti is striving to get rid of those desires and just have a desire to please the Lord. So if we have that attitude, then all those desires will more quickly dissipate. If we have mixed bhakti and we're explicitly praying for material things for the Lord, then it is more difficult, slow. Those desires do not go so quickly. So at least we should practice pure bhakti, and not worry so much about these things. They'll gradually dissipate as we go through Narta Vinti Ruchi, Nishta Ruchi, Sakti. That's another topic. Not much association, unfortunately. Of course, I mentioned the problem in Japan, like 1970. And then when we came to India. I was not a devotee then, actually, just coming to the temple. And they invited me to come to India with them, so then I came to India. And we struggled in India, because Prabhupada hadn't established anything in India at all. So he came to Calcutta and talked to people there, they didn't do anything. Then he went to Bombay and talked to people there, they didn't do anything. Moved to different places, Indore, Amritsar, all over India, and asked different people for support. They didn't give any support, whatever. And then he started a life membership program and things like this in different places. And then gradually, over a few years, we established a society in India. So we established a registered in Bombay and established a society and rented places in different places in Bombay and Calcutta, bought some property in Mayapur, and gradually developed. So I was there in the kind of beginning stages in India. Not always a problem because he sent us to different places.
And then I went back to Japan, I didn't see problem much after that.
Okay. Is it compulsory to go to heaven if he has so
much? Go to.
Is it compulsory to go to heaven if he is not able to complete the adoration service in this time? And if you don't want to, you want to come quickly. If I have not completed my devotional credits in this lifetime, and then I want to come here quickly again to reform again, regain again. So is that not possible? Or is it compulsory to heaven?
To go where?
Heavenly
planets. No, people who have mixed devotion to go to heavenly planets. Those who are practicing pure bhakti will continue pure bhakti in the most favorable circumstances. This is the success of the yogis, you know, who don't complete their process. They may be born in a rich family or whatever. The best is to be born in the family of yogis. So therefore, a person who's sincerely practicing bhakti will be born in favorable conditions where he can continue his bhakti in the future, rather than go to heavenly planets or whatever.